welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November the 1st. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a cloudy day early, then becoming partly cloudy later in the day. Winds will be out of the west at 10 to 20 miles per hour, and Cedar Rapids will see a high of 46 degrees, 47 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low of 25 degrees in both cities. Sunset tonight is at 6:01 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 7:41 a.m. for a total daylight period of 10 hours and 22 minutes. And from today's front page, fall foliage turns frosty. With the arrival of November, eastern Iowa's fall sweater weather is expected to change to winter jacket weather for this week. A cold front that began swooping Sunday across the Midwest is forecast to drive temperatures 10 to 15 degrees below normal for early November, according to the National Weather Service. For Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, that means highs dipping below 50 degrees and lows dropping below freezing for this work week. But it may bounce back next week to a more typical high above 50 for this time of the year. There could be some comforting news about the impending winter for those who can't stand cold weather. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts that for the second year in a row, the cooler Pacific Ocean waters, known as La Nina, will deflect the jet stream farther north more frequently, affecting weather patterns across the United States. The upshot is that roughly half of Iowa, a part that includes Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, will have chances leaning toward winter weather temperatures being higher than normal. The rest of Iowa is predicted to be a toss-up, could be warmer or not. The biggest impact of La Nina is in February and March. And also from today's front page, fourth version of Hickory Hill Project gains support. This is by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette staff and Dateline Iowa City. The fourth version of a proposed development near Hickory Hill Park, which already has more local support than previous versions that ultimately were rejected, will be coming Thursday before the Iowa City Planning and Zoning Commission. The updated proposal for rezoning the 48.75-acre plot northeast of the park is scaled back from previous plans and devotes nearly three times more land to the city park. Hickory Trail Estates, a senior living facility, would be built on 8.85 acres at the southeast corner of the plot, according to city documents. The facility would have 120 continuing care retirement community units with a total of 134 beds. The south end of the building would have a single-story structure memory care unit. The center of the building would be two stories and include the main entry, dining, common areas, and administrative areas. The north end of the building would be three stories of assisted living apartments. If approved, the development is expected to be constructed and fully occupied by 2025, according to documents in the agenda. Residents have opposed previous plans for the project, proposed by Axiom Consultants and Nelson Development, that included single-family homes. The development first was presented to the city's Planning and Zoning Commission in February and was shot down. The commission later endorsed a third version. The Iowa City Council twice voted to advance the plan, but then it rejected it on a third consideration. The most recent proposal does not include the single-family housing. The remaining almost 40 acres would be dedicated to the city for public open space and expansion of Hickory Hill Park. This would increase the park's size by about 21%, according to the city. The nonprofit Friends of Hickory Hill supports the revised plan. Vice Chairman Jason Napoli told the Gazette. Napoli said the group was thrilled upon hearing the amount of land that would be dedicated for expansion of the park. We were never anti-development for the residential section, Napoli said. We wanted the residential section of the development to be done responsibly and in line with Northeast District Plan. City staff recommends approval of the revised rezoning proposal. Thursday's meeting begins at 7 p.m. in the Assembly Room of the Iowa City Johnson County Senior Center at 28 South Lynn Street. If approved by the Commission, the proposal is scheduled to go before the Council during its November 30 meeting, according to the staff report. Also from today's front page, looming mental health crisis in rural Iowa. Study finds COVID-19 affects rural and urban areas differently. This is a story by Michaela Ram of the Gazette staff. COVID-19 has upended all aspects of Iowans' lives, but the impacts are very different depending on where they live, researchers have found. A new survey found that while Iowans in the smallest towns have experienced a steep toll on their mental health throughout the pandemic, those living in larger communities were more likely to experience economic challenges and strains to their physical health. Researchers from Iowa State University and the University of Iowa asked thousands of residents in 73 communities across the state to gauge how the pandemic affected various aspects of their lives, including their overall well-being and their financial situation. The collaborative study effort was funded through a grant from the National Science Foundation, an independent agency within the federal government. We wanted an idea of how rural areas were being impacted, said David Peters, a rural sociologist at Iowa State University who led the research. More than 5,000 Iowans responded to the survey, which was mailed to more than 13,500 households between December 2020 and February. What the researchers found is that communities statewide have experienced the pandemic in very different ways. The various responses were likely driven not just by Iowans' jobs and living situations, but also how they perceived the pandemic. The 73 communities studied were placed in different categories: towns with population under 3,000, towns with populations of 3,000 to 4,999, and towns with populations of 5,000 or more. The survey also measured the impact of the pandemic in four cities with meatpacking plants, Columbus Junction, Storm Lake, West Liberty, and Denison. All of these communities have minority populations that exceed 60% of the total community population. Researchers found the impact of the pandemic often was worse in those communities. Peters said these residents, who often were people of color or immigrants and tended to have lower incomes, faced increased risk of negative health outcomes and financial challenges because of their jobs. Rural Iowans of color had higher COVID-19 positivity rates and were hospitalized for the virus more frequently than residents outside of meatpacking cities. Among the respondents of color, 35% tested positive for COVID-19, and 8% were hospitalized with the coronavirus. By comparison, about 23% of white survey respondents tested positive, and about 1.5% were hospitalized. This suggests rural Iowans of color, mainly in meatpacking towns, weren't able to avoid risky situations that put them at risk for COVID-19, Peters said. That includes working in close quarters with others on a packing line or living in large households with multiple families, he said. Among those living in the meatpacking towns, 33% said the pandemic negatively impacted their financial stability, and 16% said it threatened their housing. By comparison, 21% of Iowans living in other smaller towns reported dire financial situations, and 5% reported a strain on their housing. Overall, 30% of rural Iowans responding to the survey saw their working hours reduced during the pandemic, and nearly 20% had to use their savings to make ends meet. In addition, roughly 10% lost their jobs or were unable to pay their bills as a result of COVID-19. Peter said one of the more concerning findings was that the mental health of rural Iowans had taken a major hit during the pandemic, particularly in Iowa's smallest communities. Worsening mental health poses long-lasting problems. If it's not addressed, Peter said, it could lead to other issues, including more substance abuse disorders and domestic violence. I can't overstate that we really have a looming mental health crisis, he said. In the smallest communities, about 40% of individuals reported the pandemic had worsened their mental health. In cities with more than 3,000 residents, 37% of respondents reported worsening mental health. Findings also show about 20% of rural residents showed signs of depression and 15% showed signs of anxiety, Peter said, pre-pandemic. That rate was about 6% and 3% respectively. COVID-19 has not hit Iowa's smallest towns the way it has in communities with meatpacking facilities, which is likely why residents in those smaller towns felt more of an emotional impact than a physical impact. Peters said the residents in the smallest communities were more likely to believe the pandemic was overblown. Healthcare providers told the highest spot for trusted sources of information on the pandemic, followed by public health agencies. However, the research found few trusted information from social media, news outlets, or state and federal elected officials. Turning to today's Insight page, we have a guest column by Molly Roberts, who is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post. And her piece is entitled, "Facebook's Scandal is Bigger Than Any Other." Frances Haugen loves Facebook, she swears. Surely, however, Facebook does not love her back. This purported love is key to understanding what's different about this Facebook imbroglio besides the sheer volume of documents unleashed into the ether. Because the company's dirty secrets, little and big, have been shared before, sometimes barely making the pages of major newspapers, and sometimes, as in the case of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, prompting congressional hearings. But Haugen's whistle has been heard around the world, louder than any before, and the sound hasn't stopped echoing. Her story combines the tropes of the time-tested whistleblower genre with the more modern ethos of Silicon Valley. There is our hero, as disillusioned as the rest of us, with a company that was supposed to connect us, but has ripped society to smithereens instead. And she's disillusioned, too, with her own inability to improve things from the inside. She's not going to sift through the dusty cabinets for files because this is 2021. She'll comb through the social network's own social network, where colleagues have amassed documents and data, as a technology behemoth does best. On her last day at the company, knowing her activities are logged, she'll leave in the search bar her message of forlorn love. "I don't hate Facebook," she writes. "I love Facebook. I want to save it." Why is this so compelling? Whistleblowers sometimes attract as much scorn as admiration for a lack of loyalty, the gumption it takes to decide you're right when everyone around you and above you is wrong. Looks like individualism to some and narcissism to others. Haugen splits the difference. She doesn't think she's better than Facebook. She thinks Facebook is better than Facebook, or at least it can be. Everything about her tale involves turning Facebook against itself, its values, troves of information, its words. This time, the company can't claim that naysaying outsiders, armed with an agenda but without facts, are making ignorant mischief. The nays were set on the inside, based on inside information. The passing on of this inside information hits hardest when the messenger, too, is an insider. So because Haugen's resignation plus financial support from the billionaire eBay founder turned tech critic Pierre Omidyar risks positioning her as a foe instead, she must situate herself figuratively and philosophically right in the C-suite with Mark Zuckerberg and the bigwigs. Haugen suddenly seems to carry all the authority of her erstwhile employer without any of the shadiness the down-and-out juggernaut just can't shake. The authority pays dividends to Haugen and likely yanks them away from Facebook shareholders. No company, after all, looks more out of control than when somebody else is in control, and Haugen has never let slip her hold on this conversation. From the carefully curated rollout of initial stories by the Wall Street Journal's Jeff Horwitz, including a hagiographic profile podcast hybrid, I auditioned Jeff for a while, Haugen told the New York Times' Ben Smith, to a slot on CBS's 60 Minutes, to the blockbuster testimony on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers 3 years ago couldn't fathom how Facebook made money if it was free, and they asked representatives for Google about problems with their iPhones. They have since taken small steps toward understanding, but now a savior has arrived to help them make a giant leap forward. Never mind that lots of longtime academic experts in internet governance consider many of her ideas ill-advised. Even Haugen's decision to invite journalists from more than a dozen outlets to pore over her thousands of purloined documents contributes to the effect. Yes, it's ushered in a deluge of overlapping, crisscrossing reportage that it's nearly impossible to tell what's old, what's new, and what matters. But this tsunami only increases Haugen's importance as a sort of filter guiding intercontinental movers and shakers to the shore of her insight. Facebook, meanwhile, looks as if it's drowning, precisely because its faithless lover has told the whole world she wants to save it. A piece by Molly Roberts of the Washington Post. And we have three letters to the editor today. The first coming from Amy Foster of Cedar Rapids. Her piece is entitled, Elect Carrie Davenport to Cedar Rapids School Board. Carrie Davenport is running for the at-large seat on the Cedar Rapids School Board, and she has my vote. I've known Carrie personally for many years and can attest to her ability to work collaboratively with people who may have opinions and ideas that differ from her own. Carrie says parents need to be regarded as the most important entity in the education and general welfare of students in our district. She wants to expand opportunities for the voices of parents and community members to be heard by revisiting current policy on how the board interacts with the public. Carrie is not afraid to stand up for what she believes. Her integrity is second to none, and she's a great listener. Please consider casting your vote for Carrie Davenport. And that by Amy Foster of Cedar Rapids. The next letter comes from Les Deal of Cedar Rapids. His piece is entitled, Community Should Embrace a Different Sort of Gambling. Gamble on the good things in life. Let's gamble on ourselves being worthwhile people. Let's gamble that we can help. Let's help by giving money and or our time to a person or people in need. If it doesn't seem to help, then do what you do at a casino. Do it again. If that doesn't work, maybe jump for higher stakes and give more than before. Go for the thrill of seeing others do better. What if nothing you do seems to help? Think of it like at the casino, and maybe you'll do better next time. Try it again another day, another person, or another organization. In this kind of gambling, you win by giving of yourself and by knowing that you gave the best you had. If you run a business, gamble that paying your employees more will help your business. gamble on making your product better for the end user. Gamble on service and be all you can be for the customer. Yes, it is a gamble that helping others will pay off. However, the odds are better helping others than they are at a casino. Invest in people. Gamble on the goodness within all of us. Let's be all we can be. Let's gamble on being caring, decent, kind people. How could anyone not want to gamble? That by Les Deal of Cedar Rapids. And our final letter today comes from Tim Trosky of Cedar Rapids. His piece is entitled, Voter Makes Decision on Cedar Rapids Election Issues. After seeing the TV commercials, ads, and my experiences, I made my decision on mayor and the casino. Tiffany O'Donnell is not a candidate I would consider. She offers nothing new. Who doesn't want streets fixed faster, cleanup, and flood protection? I consider this to be disingenuous and lacking of detail. From past observation, I don't think she has the leadership skills for this position. I will also not consider Amara Andrews. The mailings I received really concerned me, and especially the one with typical half-truths and pictures of the opposition in dark black and gray. That's not Iowa. I am a moderate liberal, but I am pretty sure Cedar Rapids doesn't need ideas that come from liberal California or Republican Kim Reynolds, for that matter. I don't have a problem with her declaring Democrat to get elected. Pinning down candidates is good, especially with the recent rash of candidates changing stripes after being elected. I also will not vote for the casino. There are too many unknowns. Give me a break. They have no idea where it will be or costs involved. What will we do to stop their final proposal if we don't like it? The Economic Alliance and Ron Corbett's business at any cost policy is not good government. Finally, the Gazette should check out Iowa Voter Mail, P.O. Box 574CR, to see who sent sleaze mail. And that by Tim Trosky of Cedar Rapids. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November the 1st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Karen Ann Stanford. On October 30, Karen Ann Stanford of Cedar Rapids passed away at the age of 62. A funeral mass will be held at 5 p.m. Wednesday, November the 3rd, at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 120 5th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The family will be available at 3 p.m. for anyone wanting to pay respects prior to the service. Burial will take place at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 4th, at Calvary Cemetery in Ryan, Iowa. Lunch will follow at St. Patrick Hall at 510 Howard Street in Ryan, the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Atkins, Dorothy Gillis Rathje Armstrong, age 85, passed away peacefully on Friday, October 29, at Meadowview Memory Care in Cedar Rapids. Private family graveside services will be held at McBroom Cemetery in rural Shellsburg. Memorials may be directed to St. Stephen's Lutheran Church. From Cedar Rapids, Teresa Malloy Fuller, age 65, passed away on Friday, October 29, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. The Celebration of Life gathering will be from 2 to 5 p.m., Monday, November 1, at the Bras Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest, where there will be a 5 p.m. Celebration of Life service. Private family interment will be at a later date. And from Swisher, Martha Zack, age 98, died Thursday, October 28, at her home. A Celebration of Life service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, November 5, at First Presbyterian Church near Ely. Burial will be in DuPont Cemetery near Swisher. From Cedar Rapids, Thomas Jerry Kopecky died on October 30. He was 84 years old. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 4 at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, and a memorial service is scheduled for 11 a.m. Friday, November 5 at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Burial is in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery with full military honors. The address for both is 4200 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Also from Cedar Rapids, Lisa Parsons, age 50, passed away on Friday, October 29, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, surrounded by her loving family. A celebration of life will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 3, at the Murdoch Lindwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Also from Cedar Rapids, Patricia Randall, age 80, died on Friday, October 29, at her home. Memorial services are at 1 p.m. Friday, November 5, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. From Marion, Bertie L. Schneider, age 91, passed away on May 24. Due to COVID-19, a private family celebration of life took place at Temple Judah in May of 2020. From Eugene, Oregon, Linda, also known as Lynn Marie Charpentier, of age 66, passed away on October 24 with her beloved sister Julie Pulaski at her side. An interment service will be held at 3:30 p.m. Friday, November 5, at the Bella Vista Cemetery in Bella Vista, Arkansas. And from North English, Kathleen Marie Stroman passed away at the English Valley Care Center on October 29 at the age of 91. A mass of Catholic burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 5 at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in North English. Burial will follow at Pleasant Grove Cemetery in Sigourney, Iowa. From Carthage, Missouri, Monty Peterson, age 81, formerly of Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon, died peacefully on October 24 after being diagnosed on October 2 with a mass in his brain that could not be treated. From Vinton, Connie Richards, age 80, passed away on Thursday, October 28 in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services are set for 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 6 at Wesley United Methodist Church in Vinton. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m. until the service, and interment will follow at Evergreen Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Larry Dallas Wagaman, age 76, died Saturday, October 30. The Murdoch Lindwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family with arrangements. And in other death notices today from Cedar Rapids, Donald Seedorf, age 79, died Sunday, October 31. The Brosh Chapel and the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Lost Nation, Chad Kays, age 45, died Wednesday, October 27. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. From Manchester, Mary Catherine Pink, age 93, died Friday, October 29. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is assisting the family. From Marion, Jennifer, also known as Jenny Hebert, age 46, died Saturday, October 30. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Marion, John Steve Sandor, age 78, died Thursday, October 28. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family. From Tama, Richard William, also known as Bush Benda, age 74, died Friday, October 29. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama is assisting the family. From Tipton, Roland E. Zimmerman, age 81, died Saturday, October 30. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is assisting the family. From Toledo, Betty Marie Hannes Anderson, age 88, formerly of Brooklyn, died on Friday, October 29. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo is assisting the family. From Williamsburg, Dorothy Ann Schwartz, age 97, died Friday, October 29. The Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is assisting the family. And in other deaths, William, also known as Billy Decker, age 65, of Eldridge, died Thursday, October 28. The Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have an Iowa football story entitled, Petrus Not Given Time to Throw Quarterback Under Constant Pressure from Wisconsin, a story by John Stepp of the Gazette staff. As Iowa fans learn more about the 2021 Hawkeyes, so does head coach Kirk Ferentz. You just continue to learn more about your players as the season goes on, Ferentz said. Sunday was quite the lesson as Wisconsin schooled Iowa 27-7. Here are a couple takeaways from re-watching the game. Quarterback Spencer Petras did not have his best game against the Badgers. He completed just 9 of 19 passes for 93 yards. His longest completion was for 23 yards, and it didn't come until the Hawkeyes were already down by 20 points. The blame goes well beyond just the junior quarterback, though. When offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz called a pass play for Petras against Wisconsin, there was about a 1 in 5 chance it would end in a sack. Petras rarely had more than 2 seconds before either throwing the ball or tucking it to run or making contact with the defender. At one point in the third quarter, a Wisconsin defender went unblocked on his way to hitting Petras about 2 seconds after the snap. Petras bounced off the defender and escaped before having to throw it away another 2 seconds after that. Some Petras critics have suggested starting Alex Padilla at quarterback. Padilla was much better, though, when he replaced a banged-up Petras in the fourth quarter. Padilla completed 3 of 6 passes for 39 yards in garbage time. 2 seconds to throw are 2 seconds to throw, regardless of who is under center. Iowa's defense did not have an easy set of circumstances against Wisconsin. Iowa's secondary had to play without 2 of its top 3 corners after cornerback Terry Roberts suffered an injury in practice. Iowa was already without Riley Moss. Defensive lineman Deontay Craig was also hurt and did not play, giving Iowa's defensive line 1 less option. Had Iowa's defense struggled against Wisconsin's physical offense, there would have been some understandable reasons why, but it fared much better than the score might suggest. Wisconsin quarterback Graham Mertz tried to pick on Jermari Harris early, but the cornerback, who replaced Roberts, had tight coverage on Wisconsin's Danny Davis III on a critical third down stop in the first quarter. Mertz got the better of Harris and the rest of the secondary at the beginning, completing 9 of his first 10 passes. Then the defense adjusted, and Mertz completed just 2 of his next 12 passes. On the ground, Iowa's 166 rushing yards allowed are disappointing for a defense that entered Saturday's game allowing only 89.7 rushing yards per game. As a defensive line, I feel like we shot ourselves short, defensive lineman Noah Shannon said. Allowing more than 150 yards on the ground is not like us, Shannon said. That number isn't quite as disappointing as it might first appear, though. Wisconsin averaged 218.9 rushing yards in its first 7 games, so Iowa held the Badgers to about 53 fewer yards on the ground than usual. Iowa's defense allowed 2.7 yards per carry in its first 7 games. it held Wisconsin's top running back, Chez Malusi, to 2.5 yards per carry. However, backup back Braylon Allen burned the defense for 5.2 yards per carry. The red zone defense was likely the most impressive aspect of the defensive showing. The 10 points Wisconsin scored on three drives that started in the red zone could have been 17 or 20. Here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Caregiver Gets a Hand, But Kids Foot the Bill. Dear Abby, my mother has had serious health problems lately. She had a brain tumor that was successfully removed. 4 weeks later, she needed major colorectal surgery. I stepped up and used my vacation and sick time to care for her. During Mom's illness, my car broke down, and my brother offered to get it repaired since I was with her 24/7 for about 6 months. He returned the car to me with an itemized bill for around $3,600, and I repaid him on a monthly basis. When the bill got down to about $1,200, he told me that he'd taken a collection from our family and the rest of the debt was forgiven. I just learned he didn't take a collection from our family. He took a collection from my children, and I'm very proud that they stepped up to the plate when my brother rolled them. But I didn't raise my kids expecting them to take care of me or support me in any way. Is it unreasonable of me to be angry at him for doing this? We have 75 family members. Am I right to think what he did was wrong? Signed, Bothered in the East. And Abby responds, Dear Bothered, before soliciting your children for the $1,200, it would have been better had he let the other 73 relatives know you needed a hand. Because you feel it was wrong for your children to have forked over the money, offer to repay them if it will make you feel better. But don't be surprised if they refuse. By the way, they seem pretty terrific. And from today's community page, an article entitled Soluble Moments, a story by Marissa Payne of the Gazette staff. When it comes to drinking water, several Iowa communities have high-quality H2O, says a panel of celebrity judges. But Keokuk's water emerged at the top of a sample of 7 Iowa cities drinking water. The Iowa chapter of the American Water Works Association held a blind taste test Wednesday at the DoubleTree Convention Complex to determine which Iowa community offers the best tasting drinking water. Cedar Rapids was this year's host city. The entries were judged on appearance, odor, taste, and aftertaste by a panel of local media personalities, special guests, and a host city representative. This event was part of the association's annual conference. In addition to Keokuk Municipal Waterworks, the defending champion, entries were received from Cedar Falls Utilities, the cities of Ames and Cedar Rapids, Des Moines Waterworks, Iowa Lakes Regional Water, and West Des Moines Waterworks. Cedar Rapids won the Best Tasting Drinking Water in Iowa Award in 2010, 2011, and 2013. The 4 judges noted subtle differences, particularly in the odor of the water. But Rebecca Koppelman, morning meteorologist at Iowa's News Now, said the water samples also had something in common. They're all wet. Koppelman said she previously had judged a chili contest where she tasted 23 different samples, so taste testing water was a much easier feat by comparison. As Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart drank the different water samples, he said he was still waiting to figure out how I'm supposed to cleanse my palate, to which City Utilities Director Roy Hesseman joked about giving the judges some wine as a palate cleanser. A tough call was ahead for the city's top elected official. There's a little pressure as mayor of Cedar Rapids to pick the right one, Hart said. Chelsea Reppin, business development manager for the international not-for-profit Water for People, has judged past contests and said this year's samples were absolutely so much better really 10 out of 10. Claire Duffy, co-host of the Morning Scramble on Z102.9, said, "I'm finding appearance overall stunning. Beautiful, beautiful water." After the judges finished the last drops of their water samples, Reppin suggested that future contests add density to the judging criteria to factor in how the water feels. Hart, with the diplomacy only a mayor could muster, said the great thing about the samples was that they were all good. All these samples are really, really good water. And that's a tribute to all of you and to the state of Iowa. And so we're all lucky, Hart said. There was nothing that was troubling to drink here. It was all good to drink. Hesseman also was honored with the George Warren Fuller Award during the association's annual conference. This award honors individuals who demonstrate distinguished service to the water supply field in recognition of the engineering skill, diplomatic talent, and constructive leadership that characterized the life of George Warren Fuller, an engineer responsible for important water and wastewater treatment innovations during the turn of the 21st century. And in our things to do today, we have a museum exhibit, Band 141, 140 Years of Hawkeye Marching Excellence. You can view a significant collection of materials from the Hawkeye Marching Band's history. It's from 7 to 11 p.m. at the Voxman Music Building at 93 East Burlington Street in Iowa City. The cost is free and it's for all ages. Another museum exhibit is entitled From Revolutionary Outcast to a Man of God, Dostoevsky at 200. This exhibit covers the entirety of Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky's prolific literary career. It's from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Main Library Gallery at the University of Iowa Libraries. The cost is free and it's for all ages. A health and fitness activity is entitled Metta Yoga with Prairie Woods. Experience the healing powers of meditative yoga in a spiritual and natural environment. For more information or to register, contact Heather at harbaugh@hotmail.com or call 319-389-1463. It's at 9:30 a.m. And it's at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center at 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The cost is $99 for an 11-punch card or $60 for a 6-punch card, one punch per session, and it's for all ages. And a literary activity is entitled Reading Boosts Your Brain. Hiawatha Public Library's fall reading program begins today and ends November 30. Read for 100 minutes this month and receive a prize packet. It's anytime, online, at the hiawathapubliclibrary.org/fall-reading-program. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And we have an educational hobby activity, a volunteer work day at Genealogical Society of Linn County. Volunteers are invited to work on library projects to organize and preserve precious resources. Stay as little or as long as you wish and bring a lunch. It's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Genealogical Society of Linn County at 813 First Avenue Southeast, lower level in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free and it's for all ages. And we have a community activity, the HACAP Mobile Food Pantry. This event in Hiawatha will be a drive-through pantry and will follow CDC guidelines. It's from 2 to 3 p.m. at Guthridge Park at 704 Emmons Street in Hiawatha. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And we have several Eastern Iowa briefs today. The first is from Iowa City. It's entitled, Iowa City Public Library Launches New Online Catalog System. The Iowa City Public Library has launched a new online catalog. The new catalog, now live, offers several enhancements to provide a tailored search experience to library patrons. Library staff used patron feedback to build the catalog and created one of the few in-house catalogs in the nation. The new library catalog provides better spell checking features, friendlier navigation, simpler transitions between the catalog and digital books, mobile-friendly design, and a better hold system to reserve materials, and improved account features. The new catalog is accessible at search.icpl.org. The library will host a Zoom presentation at www.icpl.org/events/39782. Get to know our new catalog at 2 p.m. Thursday to introduce the new catalog and to share search tips. Both the old and new catalogs will be accessible on the library website through January 6. During this transition period, staff will continue to improve the new catalog to make the library's collections more accessible to find, reserve, and borrow. Staff encourages patrons to try the new catalog and fill out the feedback form to share their thoughts. Patrons also may call 319-356-5200 or go to icpl.org/ask for assistance. And the next piece is entitled 17th Annual Courage Ride Raises $65,000 for Sarcoma Research. Courage Ride, a bicycle ride fundraiser for sarcoma cancer research, raised $65,000 for the University of Iowa's Sarcoma Research Program. A check ceremony was held October 21 at the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. Over the past 17 years, Courage Ride has raised more than $725,000 for sarcoma cancer research, having a major impact on cancer families and patients who benefit from the research. Courage Ride is an annual event that was founded in 2005 by Jackie and Tom Bailey of Riverside to honor the courage of their son Seth, who died at age 25 after battling sarcoma for 8 years. This year's Courage Ride was held August 14 and returned to an in-person event, in addition to also offering a virtual ride option. It included new routes from Washington, Iowa, along with multiple routes that started and finished in Iowa City. More than 500 riders participated in the event, which also included a silent auction fundraiser. All proceeds from Courage Ride go to the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center Sarcoma Research Program at the University of Iowa. From Cedar Rapids, Mount Trashmore Trails overlook close for season after November 12. The Mount Trashmore Trails and Overlook will close for the season at 4 p.m. November 12. Beginning Tuesday, the trails and overlook will be open 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesday through Sunday. The trails are closed on Mondays. The trails will reopen in spring when the weather allows. Visitors are encouraged to visit the Mount Trashmore website to check current trail conditions before heading out to visit at www.solidwasteagency.org/Mount-Trashmore. More than 16,000 people visited Mount Trashmore this year, starting in April. More than 500 people signed up for the Mount Trashmore challenge of ascending it 140 times, the equivalent of scaling Mount Everest. As of October 26, participants made 8,905 climbs and 25 people completed the challenge. And from Belle Plaine, St. Michael Church is offering carryout dinners on Sunday. St. Michael Catholic Church at 1304 9th Avenue in Belle Plaine will have a turkey and ham dinner and raffle on Sunday. This is a carryout only from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. The cost is $10 per meal. Advance tickets are available at East Side Body Shop or by calling 319-444-3366. At Grider Standard, call 319-444-2945, and at the church on the day of the dinner. And our pet of the week is Trip. Trip is a four-year-old male shepherd mix available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society at 7411 Mount Vernon Road Southeast. Trip is energetic and enjoys playing ball and being outdoors. He likes to please people but can get jumpy because of his energy, so he'll need a lot of activity. Call 319-362-6288 for more information. And we have an article from the Washington Post, but has local implications. It's entitled, "Is Pandemic Fading? Maybe, Experts Say." The pandemic isn't over, but new cases nationally have dropped below 75,000 a day, less than half the number in August. The United States will soon reopen land borders to vaccinated visitors and lift several international travel restrictions. More than 2 million people boarded flights last Sunday, not too far from pre-pandemic travel levels. Kids, many of them soon to be vaccine eligible, are back in school with no massive surge of infections. The holidays are coming, and it won't be like 2020. It's already obvious in the Halloween decorations. So over the top, it looks like people are overcompensating for last year's depressed trick-or-treating. The pandemic appears to be winding down in the United States in a thousand subtle ways, but without any singular milestone or symbol-crashing announcement of freedom from the virus. It doesn't end, we just stop caring, or we care less. Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, said when asked when the pandemic would be over, "I think for most people it just fades into the background of their lives. There still could be a winter surge. Respiratory viruses thrive when people huddle in heated rooms. Some experts said they expect at least a modest uptick in infections over the next few weeks. Last year's brutal winter wave of infections, which peaked in January, was just getting rolling at this point on the calendar. And although aggregate national numbers are lower, many cold weather states, particularly in the Mountain West, have recently seen a rise in cases and hospitalizations. Alaska has the highest infection rate in the nation." Infectious disease experts and Biden administration officials are not about to make any definitive predictions about when the pandemic might end. The virus is slippery and opportunistic. It has appeared to lose traction several times, only to surge anew as it took advantage of more lax behavior and the contagiousness of mutated variants. Even so, the trends are favorable, with most people vaccinated and infection rates dropping. The U.S. has entered a new phase of the pandemic in which people are adapting to the persistent presence of an epidemic, of an endemic, but usually non-lethal pathogen. They really have no choice. The virus isn't going away. I think it's becoming slowly part of the furniture, said Andrew Neumer, a University of California at Irvine epidemiologist. He still is wearing masks in grocery stores, but not the highly protective N95 masks. "I don't want to wear scuba gear everywhere I go. This is just part of the human environment now." That's the view as well of Robert Wachter, chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. This summer, he took to social media to warn people they need to renew their vigilance as the Delta variant took hold. But he's vaccinated and boosted now, and making his risk calculations under the assumption that our current environment is roughly as good as it's going to get, and he doesn't want to forego travel and indoor dining forever. My feeling now is that we're nearing a steady state where things might get a little better or worse for the next few years. It's not great, but it is what it is, Wachter said in an email. To me, particularly once I got my booster, it prompts me to accept a little bit more risk, mainly because if I'm not comfortable doing it now, I'm basically saying that I won't do it for several years and maybe forever. The uncertainties over what the virus will do in the coming months present a messaging challenge for the Biden administration. The White House needs people to see the pandemic as a real and present threat to public health, one that requires continued precautions and universal vaccination. Officials simultaneously want to be perceived as being on top of the situation. What they don't want is to get caught prematurely celebrating the trends of recent weeks. That happened earlier this year when vaccine uptake was going well, infection numbers were dropping, and the Biden administration projected the 4th of July as the start of a summer largely free of the virus. Today we're closer than ever to declaring our independence from a deadly virus, Biden said in his July 4 remarks. We've gained the upper hand against this virus. Then the Delta variant blew the summer of freedom to smithereens. Officials are cautiously optimistic that the recent decline in cases and deaths could continue into the winter, but they also want the public to stay on task, taking precautions to limit viral spread. Someday the coronavirus may be viewed more like influenza, but experts say we're not there yet. Don't you think people in 1943 were tired of World War II, said Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. For the record, that war lasted until the late summer of 1945. Somehow, we have to keep convincing people that this is not something being imposed on them by the government. It's being imposed on them by the virus, and we don't want the virus to win, Collins said. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November 1. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thanks for listening.